welcome to Mind Over Splatter.
What's up?
A podcast about horror movies. And it was the Super Bowl last night, and apparently somebody has memories of Super Bowl ads from like 20 years ago still stuck in their head.
Yeah, keeping it current and classy.
I'm Dylan. I'm here in Rivière du Loup enjoying a nice American wheat ale from the Knowlton Brewing Company in the Eastern Townships. And we have Sheldon hurting a little bit, I think.
Very much so. Well, I went with an 8-pack of a great American lager, Busch.
Nice.
Yeah.
Superb. A little under the weather from last night's Super Bowl party, I understand.
Very, very under the weather. We'll get through it. I got a couple more. Yeah. We'll be fine.
You've got your medicine. We'll hold tight and make it to the end.
Yeah.
And William, how you doing?
I'm doing swell. I currently have an open can of Old Speckled Hen, a nice distinctive English pale ale. And then backing up that from the Whitewater Brewing Company in the Ottawa Valley is a Midnight Stout, the Oatmeal Milk Stout.
Oh, I like those.
Nice. Important to have a deep bench.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I got to have the stout in case things get a bit, you know, out of order. I got to send my goon in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my Bob Probert.
So for tonight, I thought it'd be fun to talk about some recent horror movies, some stuff that has come out lately, and that you can maybe go see right now if you're interested. So we've got three movies that we're going to be throwing out there to discuss. Saint Maud, Psycho Goreman, and Possessor. Yeah, so let's see what's recent, what's new. So I thought I was going to start things off with Saint Maud. So yep. this is an English horror movie, a British horror movie. It's by writer-director Rose Glass. This is her first movie. Came out, I guess, earlier in 2020 in England, but it's just become more widely available here on theaters, if you're lucky enough to have a place that has those open or streaming. I'll just say that if you are isolating by yourself, if you're in quarantine alone at home, if you're feeling especially lonely, dark or depressed,
yes, Super Bowl.
For the love of God, do not see this fucking movie.
Oh.
Like, stay away. This is a good movie. I like this movie. It's powerful. It's very interesting, but it's grim as shit. This is a dark, grim, heavy fucking movie.
I'm undecided on it still.
Well, maybe I can help convince you.
Okay.
So the story, it's about a young nurse named Maud who's doing hospice care. So she's been engaged to care for a woman, former dancer and choreographer, who has a terminal illness, who lives in a house up on a hill in a small town on the English coastside. An old Gothic house, too. So right away, this feels like a ghost movie, a haunted house movie. It isn't.
Well, I was going to say, the house did look really cool. And the inside of it, too, was like well-dressed.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stained glass too, and like wallpapers, as I recall, curved wood. Definitely a beautiful old Gothic house. Turns out there are no undead ghosts haunting the premises, but Maud is a sort of living ghost who has found a house that she is going to haunt. Yeah, over the next hour and a half, the movie makes a convincing case that a living human being is maybe more horrifying and tormenting than any undead creature could be. Maud is a deeply religious young woman who has had some sort of traumatic thing that happened in her recent past when she was working as a nurse at a hospital.
Did they ever say what it was?
Not clearly.
Okay. Because I remember when the movie ended, I was like, what? I just didn't know what it was. Okay.
Yeah, we get different hints at it, like in the pre-credits scene. But you know, we never know exactly. We just have hints.
Okay.
There are hints tossed out throughout the movie that something happened. We know that somebody died, and somebody died on her care. And it was perhaps in some way her fault. We know that she's changed her name since this, right? Since characters who've known her before call her Katie, and now she's calling herself Maud. So it might have been something bad enough that happened that would have made her difficult to employ. Yeah. But we never know exactly what. Her past is still very opaque in this movie.
She picked her own name, to be clear, and she picked Maud.
Odd choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll allow that's an odd choice. But since she has decided to become a deeply religious person who is just devoting her whole life to God. It kind of makes sense that she would pick such a drab name because she wants to be this kind of drab, empty vessel. And she's going to care for an older woman who's obviously lived a completely different type of lifestyle from Maud. She's lived you would think a cosmopolitan, artistic life. She's an atheist. She sleeps with women. She's a totally different sort of person than Maud is. But of course, the two of them do begin to form a bit of a bond, isolated one another in each other's company. They do start to seem to get to influence each other and maybe even feel the boundaries between one another start to blur a little bit. So right away, we're entering territory that kind of feels like an Ingmar Bergman movie or something, like Persona. It feels a little familiar, the setup, in a good way. You know, this is fertile territory. Another movie this setup reminded me of is Shirley. I don't know if you guys saw that. No. From this past year. Not exactly a horror movie, but a movie that has a lot of like horror vibes. Elizabeth Moss plays Shirley Jackson, a writer in the 50s. And there's also a young woman who's looking after a little bit, and they form kind of an intense and unexpected relationship. I was expecting the setup to continue, so I was a little surprised when it didn't. And instead, we end up tunneling down deep into Maud and only Maud and nobody else. We become very suffocatingly close to this one character. Extremely so. Enter really intensely lonesome, sad, and futile life that we just burrow down on with a single-minded focus. Maud cares about nothing but her relationship with her God, which she thinks that she can sometimes communicate with. Sometimes she seems to have a form of telekinesis, perhaps, that's been given to her by God. But by this point, we've become so deeply invested into her perspective of everything that we can no longer really trust what we're seeing on screen as being reality. Maud's chillingly earnest devotion to God is matched only by the movie's chillingly earnest devotion to Maud. It starts to feel almost like we, as the audience, are snapping into place, occupying the empty gaze that she imagines God to have. When we actually do see a moment of her communicating with God, she's actually looking towards the camera, which I think kind of reinforces that reading of it. Though she might just be talking to a cockroach. Not too sure.
More than likely, yeah.
Yeah. A cockroach who speaks Welsh. So yeah, there is a cockroach that appears sometimes.
Oh,
it's hard to say what it's doing.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out what the purpose of that was at all.
So I think there's a couple things there. I think it has something to do with your relation to kind of a raw, naked life, like as life itself, as just this creeping thing living out its miserable existence, crawling across the wall, the way kind of Maud is living her life and the way she sees all life being okay at this point. I didn't say it was a lighthearted movie, remember? But one thing it kind of reminds me of, and I don't know if this is just accidental or not, it probably is, but I think this movie has in its DNA a lot of the old British social realist movies that there were in like the 60s. They used to call them kitchen sink movies, like A Taste of Honey. Or This Sporting Life is one that I like a lot. And This Sporting Life has this image of a spider crawling on the wall once in a while that is kind of infuriating to the main character, played by Richard Harris, who's incredible in that movie. You should absolutely see the movie just for that performance.
What's this one called?
This Sporting Life. So it's like a 1960s British realist movies. In Britain in the 60s, they made these extremely realist movies that were about, you know, class and people living very kind of horrible lives in many cases, and often about angry young men stuck in these terrible English lifestyles.
Kind of like a Bruce Springsteen song.
Yeah, except with like a Cockney accent and a really short tie.
Fuck, I love short ties. Okay.
Yeah, short ties are great.
I've been going through a lot of those lately, actually. Things like even like Georgie Girl and Taste of Honey and a lot of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like these movies a lot. And I think a lot of those movies' DNA is kind of in Saint Maud too. It's also an extremely realist movie. It doesn't really fit the mold because it doesn't show the broader social conditions, because it's so concerned with tunneling down on this one character and only seeing the world through her eyes. But mm-hmm. I felt a kinship between that image of the spider on the wall in This Sporting Life and the image of the cockroach on the wall that returns several times throughout Saint Maud. in these those British kitchen sink movies, like I say, you're invited to look at the broader social spectrum and the context. After watching Saint Maud, a movie like that, or other famously humanist movies like Italian neorealism or films by Robert Bresson or the Dardenne brothers, that they invite you to gaze with a benign Franciscan beatitude down on the subjects of this sad world. Those almost feel kind of condescending and self-congratulatory and even cowardly compared to Saint Maud, which invites no such moist-eyed sympathy to its character, but is kind of tethering you to the character and dragging you through the crucible with her unblinkingly and will not let you detach. The movie makes a commitment to this character that seems to match this commitment that she makes to God, which is kind of disconcerting for the audience because you really don't want to be Maud's God, which seems like almost as terrible as being Maud herself. So I keep mentioning movies that are not horror movies as they refer to this movie, and maybe that's because it's not that much of a horror movie, but it also feels kind of like an intensely horror movie because it is a movie that shows life itself as being a horrible condition.
For Maud, yeah.
Yeah, for Maud. But again, because we're invited to see it, the world only through her gaze, that's the perspective of the movie as well. It's not just her perspective, it is the movie's perspective, because that is the one angle from which we're allowed to view anything. Maud has a slogan that she says a few times, which is never waste your pain. She's assigning a sort of value to her pain, which you feel is only realized if it's observed. And I guess nobody's doing the observing except for us, which is kind of the dark, twisted take of extreme humanism that this movie invites us to consider. It's almost embarrassing to consider you're enjoying other movies' multiple perspectives after you've been yoked to Maud's bleak perspective for so long. So I thought it was very hard-hitting for that reason and extremely intense and extremely interesting. If you're looking for a movie that will just beat the shit out of your soul and then squeeze lemon juice in your soul's many wounds and lacerations, then do I have a movie for you? It's called The Boss Baby. And I think I've sufficiently underscored the fact that Saint Maud is a very dark and grim movie, but very powerful and intense for those reasons. Mm-hmm. If it does have a kinship with a classic horror movie, the comparison that leaps to mind would be Carrie.
Mm. Yeah.
Not formally, not in like the structure of the movie or anything like that. It's obviously a different feel for a film, but we're talking about a young woman who is oppressed by her own intense religion and develops telekinetic powers, potentially, hard to say. So I think that's a comparison that's hard to avoid making.
They're definitely right. So when I thought watching this movie, as a person who doesn't believe in any of that, mm-hmm. like it gives you two perspectives, because if, like, as me not believing any of that, I just assume she's a mentally ill young woman slowly getting worse and worse as the movie goes.
And I think that's unavoidably the case.
But imagine as a religious person watching, they might think completely differently. Right? They give you both sides of the story. Like when she has like a couple seizures during the movie where she like shakes a little bit and whatever. And then in one scene, in her point of view, she like levitates. Uh-huh. And then we get the same thing at the end of the movie where we get two perspectives.
Yeah, true. When we see her levitating, we see it in like an uncharacteristic wider angle. So we are kind of being invited to see this as something that is actually happening and not just something through
her perspective. Oh, I think that's her view, because they showed her having seizures previously to that scene. Mm-hmm. So I thought we were getting like that one perspective and then her perspective.
Okay, yeah. I see what you're saying. It might be that.
Yeah, that's what I kind of thought from that levitation scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to avoid the obvious conclusion that she's just deeply unwell. She's extremely mentally unhealthy, and I think that's the truth. But the movie wants us so badly to see things from her perspective as well, and kind of won't accept that we just diagnose her from the outside.
I have seen debates about whether it is, in fact, a horror film, so I'm glad you remarked on that. It sounds horrifying enough. I know some are quick to say that, it seems, when it just doesn't have certain familiar elements like how the supernatural might be used or a certain amount of blood or gore, like they if it doesn't shock you in that way. But things that are, you know, psychologically damaging, I find to be all the more horrific. So it's, I assume that you're both leaning towards it being a true horror film.
Yeah, I would say.
I took it that way. Told Dylan earlier this week as I watched it, it actually reminded me of Joker with Joaquin Phoenix.
Me too.
Yeah, I messaged you that and you said me too. And I was like, okay.
No, I definitely had that thought while I was watching the movie.
Yeah, it just kept on going to my mind. It's like, this movie reminds me of Joker.
Yeah, he's also somebody who's like intense loneliness and alienation is setting him into this spiral, and you start to doubt the reality of what you're seeing because your perspective is so closely identified with his perspective.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's big differences. Joker pans out to more things as well. And I think another big difference is that Saint Maud is truly a feudal character. Like she truly has such little impact or effect on anybody else around her. She's just as isolated as she thinks she is.
Yeah, like so many characters come and go, and that's it, right? Her friends come and go. She meets people in the park.
Whereas one of the things that I thought was a little strange about Joker was that you have this character who's totally alienated, isolated, and thinks his life has no purpose. But he's like weirdly impactful with everything he does, too. Like he kills somebody and suddenly the whole city's obsessed with it. You know, he does one round of shitty stand-up and suddenly he's being invited on the most popular talk show.
Yeah. I have one more thing to say about Maud. So this is the reason why I kind of didn't like it, or I was on the fence. Just the subject matter kind of throws me off. Like I try not to watch movies with that subject matter.
I hear you, but it's so super rare to have a contemporary movie that is about somebody who is so intensely devoted to religion in a way that feels like medieval.
Another thing also, which leans me towards liking it a little bit more, is how creepy that character is. And there's like a lot of people in the real world that are exactly like her, who believe these crazy things are happening to them and someone's sending them signals and this and that.
Oh yeah, totally.
That's what's creepy about it, because it's like real world creepiness. Like this is real.
There are probably way more people similar to that than you would like to think about. And that's what the movie is doing, is by forcing us to think about one such person. They force us to confront that that kind of horror of this world that is so populated by people going through these terrible periods. And I should also mention the name of the actress who plays Maud, Morfydd Clark, because she fucking knocks it out of the park. That's an amazing performance in a movie that is basically just her performance for most of its runtime. I was going to say the only other movie I could think of at any point recently that has a similar theme about religiousness would be First Reformed, the Paul Schrader movie with Ethan Hawke. I don't know if either of you guys saw that.
I'm not.
But it also is about a character who's extremely deeply religious in like a self-flagellatory, like medieval monk kind of way, but in the modern world reacting to these the world he sees around him in the only way that he thinks is right. If God were actually watching him. And I agree with you, Sheldon, that it's uncomfortable as somebody who's not religious to watch these movies that are explorations of intense religiousness. But there's plenty of those people out there, and you hardly ever see it in movies.
It's funny because the mood that's created doesn't matter if it's a contemporary piece, or I just was recently seeing things taking place with the Puritans and like the Salem witch trials, and we're talking hundreds of years. And yet I can see this through line of the same reaction I get is when I see a modern take on people that are, you know, either doing horrible things to themselves mentally or doing horrible things to others, perhaps physically or mentally, through these beliefs. And it's just kind of a consistent thing. It doesn't matter what era you depict, it comes off the same way. Perhaps that's my own cynical point of view.
Like Maud keeps saying, never waste your pain. She seems to have this perspective that the pain is the only residue that's left in the world when the bodies are left. Like this is just the only thing we have in common in a certain way, which is bleak as shit. But you see this as a through line that goes back through medieval times and probably back before the beginning of history.
Sounds like James Woods to kick down the door and say, "All hail the new flesh."
Yeah. Cronenberg episode coming up.
Yep. Oh, no. Yeah, we got a Cronenberg it up for sure.
We do have a Cronenberg that's going to be brought up.
We do, yeah.
Tonight.
Yeah. Junior.
Oh, little crony. So after that darkness, I think maybe we need a little palate cleanser. Let's move on to something a little more fun.
Cool. So, yeah, I'm here to discuss PG, Cycle Gorman, which is, of course, a rape revenge film in the same vein as Last House on the Left. Featuring a weird twist on body horror, explicitly in the rape scenes. No, I no, it is so much easier to digest than that.
Not that it's a movie free of body horror.
No, it it relishes in that too. It's an interesting film in that it reminds us of so many others, and yet it is incredibly unique at the same time. It's kind of the plot of E.T. in that we have these young children come across an otherworldly being. But in this case, it's as if E.T. was also Thanos or Skeletor or some major super villain. Cycle Gorman, which is a name only given to him by the kids. He usually goes by the Archduke of Nightmares. But even that, he's normally a nameless being that simply exists to destroy other landscapes. He is found by way of a gem that's buried in the kid's backyard that they are digging as part of a forfeit for a game that they play that they also invented. And once they possess this gem, Cycle Gorman must do everything they say. And we have the main character, Mimi, is a one of the more consistently annoying lead characters in a film in any era, which is both it's a hindrance to so many viewers, but it's also a plus to others. It can be really funny. It functions decently in this film, but yeah, she is a bit grating.
And I like Mimi.
Yeah, that's the thing. She when she gets fans, they are earned. She is 100% Mimi.
I just like how she's just so fucking intense about everything.
Exactly. Yeah, she is. If you're not if you don't want to hop into a car that's already in the fourth gear, don't align with Mimi, because that's where she's at. She's always in that gear and doesn't relent, which is great. It's consistent. I like characters that are consistent. There's no, it's not even like she has a much change or arc to change her personality. She is 100% Mimi throughout the story. Comes to a head where these Templars, the people, these alien beings, this Council of Aliens who originally tried to destroy him, but they could only contain him, realize that he is free again, and so various beings arrive to try and stop him. All the while, he's slowly learning a bit of humanity, perhaps, but not really. The only real sign is that his sexuality gets questioned at one point. In the movie's funniest line,
that made me actually laugh out loud.
That's been everyone's favorite so far.
I don't that's, like hunky boys.
That's not my favorite laugh line. My favorite laugh line was when he's confronting the what are they called, like the Obsidian Paladin or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so many great names for groups of creatures and stuff, yeah. And they betray him. Minor spoiler, not a huge one. No. And he's like, "I didn't expect this from you, except for you, Cassius 3000. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, Cassius, who's like sort of an Errol Flynn looking alien who's constantly in a fencing pose.
Right, with a mechanical bird on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Enjoyed all those characters up in whatever they were in the council meeting.
Yeah.
Every one of those characters looked so cheesy and funny.
Yeah, you could see that they seem to be from like other films. There's so many homages sitting at this round table. Yeah, Cortex, the Grand Magistrate, and Hiss, and yes, it just the amount of characters. It's an absolute treasure trove of costuming effects and character design. It's so fun, and I will put up the little for any listener out there disclaimer that yes, I am a part of the film, but that does not affect my opinion of it.
Hold on now. Were you naked in this film?
I wasn't naked in this one.
Fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Even when you recorded your audio lines, you didn't you wore clothes for that?
If the characters were naked on screen, I might, just to, you know, voice acting is still acting. And you want to capture as much of the character as possible. So I would have, but alas, all the characters I voiced were clothed or armored.
Sign of a voice acting professional. Puts on pants and everything.
Yeah, exactly. It is intensely enjoyable. It's funny because it harkens to so many different types of films. There's clearly just references abound, but it does still sort of stand on its own as a very unique experience. Like, you get these tropes that are come out of various like 80s and 90s films, like what's meant to be, you know, like the parents giving the life lesson to the child, and the sort of the fish out of water Harry and the Henderson style situation where they've got this something fantastic, or like Mac and Me, all just you know, derivatives of E.T. any that are out there. But it has this unique vibe that the director Stephen Kostansky brings to the type of effects that he has. Like, there's cheesy gore, and then there's stuff that is kind of haunting. Like that one guy who is initially sent into eternal suffering is alarming, where he's just in this horrified, petrified state, but his eyes are constantly rolling back in his head as he goes through the most intense agonies ever to be brought to that universe. And his only relief is when he has accidentally tipped over and his head explodes. And he asks, in another great effect, just, "Thank you," while lying on the ground, finally exterminated. That was genuinely, like, I think about that quite a lot. And I didn't expect that out of a film that has, you know, like at another point, a young boy turned into a giant brain with tentacles, who then has to try and figure out how to eat dinner with these tentacles.
and play the keyboard from time to time.
And play the keyboard for their little garage band.
Like, which is horrifying in its own way.
It is. Like, there are some people that do have that fate worse than death type situation. Like, the ending credits has that poor boy trying to, like, eat and live a normal life, but he's just a giant brain with eyes. And yeah, it's incredibly silly.
I do love the combination of often having like a 80s kids movie tone, but then, like you said, just occasionally swerving into horrifying nightmare imagery. I like this movie a lot. I had a great fucking time watching it. I like how the start of the movie kind of sets the tone, where the brother and sister, Mimi and Boy, are playing their ball game, crazy ball. Mm-hmm. And we kind of cut between their like view of it as being incredibly intense, and, you know, some wide shots where it's just like couple stupid kids playing the stupid game. But the movie kind of follows that mold of switching gears between like intense mythology, monster wars shit, and just silly ass like suburban kids movie from the 80s vibes.
They even have a beautiful moment like that in one of my favorite gags, where they have the diner scene and they're just doing like little gags there, and where he starts to tell a story, and anytime Psycho Gorman starts to tell a story, they are always interrupted. And they have this amazing shot where he's driving some sort of floating hell cycle towards this gigantic Lovecraftian, like, planet-sized monster on, like, the Rainbow Bridge. And that's all you see. Just quickly a snap of that, and you're right back to the diner. The kids have zero interest in hearing the story.
Yes, so great. The whole scene where he's telling the stories is just full of these amazing moments of these amazing effects moments, you know, like stop motion effects and stuff. Plenty of fun, like rubber suits and lasers action, filling us in on all this incredible mythology and backstory and shit. And then they just keep getting back to the diner, and the kids are like, "Okay, shut up. This is boring."
Much world building. Like, you can see there's so many layers to it. You've got these, you can have like 15 different series just following either the council or the Obsidian lieutenants or Gorman himself. Like, everything has so many interesting things. You want to see how each of the villains came to be that villain. Like, you know, be they Cassius or Darkscream or that one who's just a bucket of body parts. Blood.
My favorite one.
He doesn't actually have much of an attack. He doesn't seem that deadly. He's just very gross.
Yeah, I love the range of characters that are created, and I just love the really obsessive and caring detailing and craftsmanship that went into all this, both in the mythologizing that just gets like briefly alluded at from time to time, and of course the craftsmanship that went into the effects and creating all these distinct characters and bringing them to life with these kind of Japanese tokusetsu rubber suits, like an, you know, an Ultraman or Kamen Rider series kind of vibe, and so much attention and care and love went into that, even when often it's just for like the tiniest couple of seconds of backstory that will appear on the screen. You feel that, right? You feel the love that went into this movie. You feel how the obsessive detail and care and the adoration for the vibes of these old movies and TV shows that inspired it. And I love that about it. It's infectious. It's great to see a movie where you can feel the creator's love for something weird and niche, and you just, you know, hook it up to your veins and you absorb that.
Yeah, absolutely. I witnessed it firsthand, and it is every little aspect. It's right down to like the director/writer. He was in there building each of those things, like doing all the design work, molding everything, writing out character name after character name, and just wanting to make an entire universe. Like, never mind having 18 MCU films. It's like, we have it in one. Here is like 27 characters ready to go. We are already at Avengers Endgame. We're starting at Endgame, where everything has to come and fight Thanos, and it's Psycho Goreman. We'll just worry about prequels later.
So you've worked with Stephen Kostansky a number of times, as you've mentioned, right?
Yeah.
Do you know, is this like something that he's been planning for a while, or did this come together pretty quickly?
Well, the opportunity to make it, he had been waiting for a while, because like once you get into a certain rhythm as a director, often you have to do, like some will just stick to doing the money projects, like just get, you got to work so you can work. But he was bouncing between doing stuff that he really wanted to do, like more passion projects, but then having to pay the bills. So you do a film that, you know, you might not be putting all of your heart into. And this was coming on the heels of him doing one of the Leprechaun films. That's not a movie that he put like heart and soul into. That's just, it was a gig. And he did his best work as possible, but he was confined. He had to follow other people's rules. And then he had a bit more freedom, where the producers realized, okay, he can do good work. What would you like to do? And they gave him a bit of money, and Psycho Goreman was what he wanted to do. It was an idea that it wasn't exactly kicking around for years, but it wasn't, because there's elements to it that are like meant to stick around. Like, if given the chance, there could be more. And even like the cop character is very definitely a reference to BioCop, the short film that appears at the end of Manborg, if you have seen that.
I have not.
It was just made as kind of a gag. And it's a short film just after, it's like a trailer, fake trailer, basically, at the end of Manborg. And that short film got a ton of cult fandom. Like, there's people, I saw people getting tattoos of it. Like, they just loved this character. And so the cop character in Psycho Goreman is played by the same person who plays BioCop. And they are kind of a similar-ish type of creature, in that they're a, you know, a cop who is then transformed into this constant suffering, dying creature. Like, BioCop, the whole gag in BioCop is that he's trying to kill himself. Like, he's got these like superpowers, but every shot is he's trying to blow his own brains out. He's jumping in front of cars, all the while trying to do a buddy cop film. And that character played by Bobby Homer was the exact same. And so that kind of harkens into, Steven has the idea for an expanded universe. All these characters are all milling around his head. And they have been for a long time.
And I was wondering if just for anybody who's listening who's just never heard of these movies before, could you maybe just give us like a quick overview of the films of Steve Kostansky and Astron 6, the collective that he used to be a part of, as somebody who's seen them from the inside over the years?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to kind of be the sixth Beatle in a lot of occasions, where we all started making short films in Winnipeg, where we lived, and I still do. It was for the Short Film Massacre. That was the name of the local little film festival that we had here, and it was kind of becoming apparent that certain people were just kept winning. And from that, we all sort of eyeballed each other. If Steve Kostanski was entering it, we all kind of gave up and realized, well, we can shoot for second. They had prizes for first, second, and third, but if you knew Steve was entering, he was going to win. He started by making short films like Fantasy Beyond, Carl, Insane Ophenia, which was the first one that I did fully with him, where I was the main character. I helped him write it. My face gets melted off in it. I die in pretty much every Astron thing I'm a part of, except The Editor. The Editor is the only film I don't die.
That's my favorite one.
So then he started working on Manborg, which was literally shot in his garage and in the basement of Super Blinds. So amongst, we just would move all the Access blind stock out of the way, put up a green screen. That's where a lot of like the city shots, a lot of the big stuff was done. The fights were choreographed in the University Center late at night at U of M. And that cobbled together Manborg, which cost $1,000 to make. Took like 3 years to piece together because it was just done in our free time. I was just paid in Burger King to do it. That ended up being such a massive cult film that it helped spark a lot more out of Astron 6. Because then things like Father's Day came around, which was hell for them to make, but they actually started with a bit of budget, and then Troma helped pay for the rest of it, much to their chagrin. They would still make the odd short here and there, but they started to diverge a bit more. Astron still was working on things like The Editor is very much an Astron 6 film, but Steve's involvement, he had moved to Toronto at this point. He was working on a lot of major productions. He'd already been a special effects person for a long time, working on things like Wrong Turn or the Chucky films that were filmed in Winnipeg. But since he moved to Toronto, he started working on like Guillermo del Toro's films and knew him personally. And in fact, when he then went on to make The Void, it was the same editing suite and team that did Crimson Peak that worked on The Void, because he had done design work. He had done creature work for Crimson Peak, and then the editing team helped him out with The Void, his other feature film, which is the only real true serious film kind of in the, it's not an Astron 6 film, but of his, that's the only one that's kind of truly 100% serious. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting, you know, Lovecraftian kind of horror film. So that's just kind of where he's at now. And then he's working on, he just did finish Day of the Dead, the latest remake of that.
I mean, obviously there's a ton of references in Psycho Goreman. Is there one movie that you think if somebody watched Psycho Goreman and fucking loved it, is there one older movie that you would maybe recommend they follow up on that they potentially might not have seen?
Like, there's stuff that it reminds me of, but it's not necessarily like the tone of the film's very different. It's like, if you liked just the costumes, you got to look up the Dolph Lundgren Masters of the Universe He-Man film. But that's, you know, totally, obviously, completely different animal. It's like if you liked certain schlocky bits, like I know he is an admirer of the dialogue of movies like Cyborg and Eliminators. So there's that. If you're a fan of it, definitely look up the alternate ending to Mac and Me, because I didn't realize that was a thing. And then when I discovered it, holy fuck, is it dark. Are you guys, like, I'm sure you guys are familiar with that. It's like the E.T. ripoff.
I'm familiar with it, but I've never seen it.
Like the kid in the wheelchair, and like how Paul Rudd always uses it on the Conan O'Brien show. And
right.
Yeah, the alternate ending, I don't know if you want me to describe it or if you just want to go find it. It's ridiculous. It's so fucked up. So yeah, definitely find that clip. Everybody, it's just everybody dies. Like, it's bad enough that, like, the lead kid, like, you feel so bad he's in a wheelchair. And then you see him get shot right in the heart. And his chair keeps moving. And then the aliens just use, like, telekinesis to ignite everything. Like, what were they thinking? Who was that for? And that's clearly an expensive shot. Like, it had giant pyro. Who the fuck? So, anyways... Yeah, that's the thing. It's totally confusing.
Yeah, another thing that I really appreciated too is just how like stubbornly amoral the movie is. Like they refuse to have anybody be a hero or have anybody learn a lesson of any sort. I just love how they refuse to let morality enter the film in any way.
Yeah. Is it a happy ending? Like it kind of is and kind of isn't, but not in ways you expect. It's like, yeah, this turned out good for some people, but even then, did it? Oh yeah, there we go. Steve's film from, have you seen the ABCs of Death?
Yeah.
But yeah, ABCs of Death. And ABCs of Death 2, Steve did a segment in that. And the one he chose in that also has a very, very, very similar vibe. W is for Wish. And Brandon Cronenberg is in that. I think he directs one of those, and he's also in W is for Wish.
Okay. So speaking of Brandon Cronenberg.
Somebody yeah, Brandon Cronenberg.
My bush. So the movie I watched recently and reviewed was a Cronenberg film. David Cronenberg's son, Brandon Cronenberg. I think it's the second movie. I have Antiviral.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's his first or...
Yeah, I believe Antiviral was his first. I still haven't seen Antiviral, actually. Did you see that?
I have it. I have watched it. It was okay.
Okay.
Like, you see the Cronenberg name and you just immediately... At least people like us are drawn to it, right? You see the name, you want to watch it.
Yeah, that's fair. The Cronenberg is a pretty good stamp. Not that he's infallible, but...
Yeah, not that, like, filmmaking talent is genetic or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
No, not at all. Having said that, after watching now Antiviral and Possessor, they're very, like, they have very similar styles. They bombard you with, like, squeamish... like gruesome imagery to make you like look away, as in The Fly, or and same with Antiviral, like the needles going in and out of the people's teeth. And then the start of Possessor shows a needle going into the person's head. It's obviously gruesome. Yeah, so I'm still kind of confused with this movie. I just watched it again earlier today for the second time. And I'm kind of at... Same thing with Saint Maud, where I was like, do I like it or don't I like it?
It also goes hard. Like, not in the same...
From the start.
Yeah, it's an aggressive movie.
And also, like, it was hard to decide whether it's a horror film or not. Because basically, it's just, like, at its core, like, your basic meat and potatoes assassin movie. There's someone hired to kill someone, and they go and... complete the objective. That's what we're watching. But with... on top of that, they add in a way to complete this objective with getting away scot-free.
Which is possession. Yeah, it's sci-fi possession.
Yeah, so what we got people going into other people's bodies to do hits. And when their hit is finished, they then off themselves to go back into their regular body, and then it seems like a murder-suicide.
There's like a shady organization of some form.
Yeah.
Perhaps a government organization. I think it's not clear if they're government or not, who compiles targets of people that need to be killed for whatever reason.
They never told us the reason, which I found really weird.
It kind of ups the creepiness factor that we don't really know what this agency is exactly. They're kind of like a CIA or something.
Yeah. Yeah, like a dark organization. From what I took in this movie, it was about one hit woman who was like, I guess, doing her job incorrectly or not as good as she had done it before in the past. And then her trying to correct that as the movie goes on.
Failing at that in that mission.
Failing, yes. Yeah. Basically failing.
Yeah, so we have Andrea Riseborough plays the assassin who gets plugged in and then her consciousness gets... imported into another person who has to be first kidnapped, right? And then they get a little implant in the back of their skull. And then the person gets released back into their regular everyday life, except they're actually controlled by another consciousness, which is the consciousness of the assassin. And then, yeah, when she fucks up her second kill, shit gets weird.
The host is fighting back a lot on the second attempt. Where maybe it's because of her failing job.
She's succeeding in her job, except that the weird thing is that when she's supposed to just shoot her targets, she ends up brutally killing them by stabbing them or, hitting them with a fire poker and shit. And it's kind of not clear why this is happening, but there seems to be some sort of psychic damage that's been inflicted to her from this operation that she keeps undergoing.
Yeah.
This psychological procedure where she has to inhabit other people's bodies and pretend to be them. She's clearly losing track of her identity, which is obviously an occupational risk. They make that clear from the start. They have a sort of test to determine whether you've managed to hold on to your identity after you return or not. But this is clearly a problem. And this problem seems to be related to her weird bursts of violence against her targets.
Yes. Right off the bat, she's doing a test. They're trying to know if she remembers things of her own identity, like, is this yours? Is that yours? Do you remember this? Whatever. And they put up a picture of a butterfly, and she says, that's mine, and I feel guilty about killing it. Mm-hmm. She seems a little, like, off-put with this. Like, she was kind of sad about killing this butterfly as a hitman who kills humans.
Yeah.
And then later on in the movie, it comes back at the end. Not to spoil it, but they bring up the butterfly again. The butterfly thing seems like a... like the main factor in this movie.
They show that it's important because it happens at the start and at the end of the movie.
Very start and very end, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the other things I got from it is that I feel like she's just memorizing what to say. And I feel like the implication is that she really has lost a grip on her own identity.
No, I don't think she's memorizing what to say, because at the very start there's that one item that she says, no, I don't remember this.
Yeah, but doesn't she get the exact same items the second time she does the test?
The item she doesn't remember isn't in the last test.
Right, but the ones she does remember are the same ones that she remembers from the start. So she may have just committed to memory these specific objects that she's being tested on. So I kind of feel like her handler, is played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, and she's great.
Amazing.
As she usually is. I feel like she knows that that the assassin, I think her name is Tasia, has lost control of her identity. But wants to let her feel that she's still in control of herself, because she wants to keep using her as a useful agent.
Well, she's already labeled as like the best agent they have.
Yeah.
And she was slowly losing it when the movie starts.
There's a lot of stuff about losing control of your identity in this movie. And I think that's what makes it really creepy, and a movie that's really stuck with me since I watched it. That's been really haunting, just because it's really about this idea of like what your identity is and if you can just watch it slip away. And it's creepy how easily she slides into another identity and then slides into brutality too. Like
there's... the scenes where they slide in and out of into the other person's consciousness and whatnot were probably the best parts of this movie.
Yeah, because they make it really horrifying, because they throw in some weird effects and shit in there. There's some like weird body horror effects that just appear on, I guess, the subconscious level that's visualized in the movie when these moments of breaking through from one identity to another happen. So you really feel viscerally how horrible this experience is. Yeah. It's really driven home how horrible this feels to be put in and out of a different...
Flash like 2, 3, 4 of them in a row. So you get a clear view of what's happening.
And then when she inhabits the guy's... body and losing control of who she is, she decides to stab in the back of her head the little thing that's been implanted that allows her to keep in there. And then we get this whole sequence of horrible imagery where she sees herself as taking a mask of her own face and putting it on.
Well, that scene, the entire scene of like her face being her head being crushed, and then the male character putting the face skin on his, was very Texas Chainsaw Massacre-like.
Yeah.
It was so creepy, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ending is does have some twists in store. And there is the subplot that we haven't mentioned yet about she does have a family. She has a young son and her ex-husband or ex-partner, who she visits early on in the movie.
When we first see those characters, as she's coming into the house, she's like rehearsing as if she was going to like a job interview or something.
Yes.
She was saying, hi, darling. No. Hi, darling. Over and over again.
She's rehearsing how to be herself, because she's not sure that she can just call it forth without playing the role of being herself. And then what's also creepy is that when the wires get crossed and after she's stabbed the implant, and the two identities are becoming mixed together in horrible ways, she returns to her ex-husband's house and is also kind of performing the role of being herself, but can't quite get a handle on how to do it. And that really creeped me the fuck out, because you know there's a kind of tension between her and her ex-husband, as would be
normal. Yeah, we don't know exactly what it was, but probably her work.
Yes. Yeah. But now that she's in Colin's body, she seems to have interpreted this tension, these disagreements, as grounds for killing somebody like he was one of her targets. But it's creepy how easily she grasps onto any animosity and makes it her own. But more complex social relationships seem out of grasp when she's in this mode. The boundaries that define her are loosened. I like these frightening implications of what happens when all your external identity, you know, the people who know you, your job, everything yeah. else that defines you, when that's all stripped away, what do you have left that is your identity? And for her, I almost feel like she has to cling to these impulses, urges that she has, and has to act out on them, because it's all that she can grasp that is her. Without any of the social stuff, without any coding, without any friends, without any boundaries to define her as a person, as a personality, as somebody who has a career, these impulses and urges, these base feelings are the only thing that she can grab onto that is something that I know this is me and not another person. So yeah. she acts out on those because that's all she has.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's kind of a creepy examination of, you know, what it actually means to be the person you are, and how when you try to actually define that, it gets really slippery, hard to pin down, with potentially frightening implications. They really go wild with that premise, and it hits fucking hard. The scenes of violence hit pretty hard.
Yeah. Well, like I said, like you know what you're getting into with that Cronenberg film. Like intense, gruesome violence. And that's what we got.
Yeah. I really liked Andrea Riseborough as the main character. One issue I had with the movie was that the actor who plays Colin the target, Christopher Abbott, I think is the actor, I found him really dull.
I think he was trying to be that dull to replicate the main assassin.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that too. I was like, did they purposely want a dull performance to...
That's what I got from it.
Yeah, I wondered if they wanted him to be a blank slate for that reason. Good supporting turn by Sean Bean as Rich Asshole.
Does he die in the movie?
No.
He's supposed to.
See him later.
He survives, yeah.
A rare move for Sean Bean. I'm trying to go for his record. Dying in cinema. Like it's a large hill to climb, I know, but still he's the one to beat.
I tried to like think of another horror movie this resembled to me, or any other movie.
Yeah, it doesn't have many comparables, which is a compliment to the movie.
The Cronenberg film is their own, other than The Fly, obviously.
I feel like we shouldn't mix up too much Brandon Cronenberg and David Cronenberg. They are separate human beings.
They are, with a lot of same genes in them. And the movies, I don't know, they seem very similar.
It's true.
Yeah. Of the three, I think I like St. Maud the best.
Really?
I think so. Like, it made me feel differently. Rather than laying down and watching a movie and having shit happen on TV.
Yeah, it's something that's not just going to glide off your back. It's going to smash you hard in the brain.
Yeah, I got to go with my boy PG.
It might be a horror movie. That was my thing.
Yeah, it's a comedy. It's a comedy for sure.
To be fair, we're being pretty big tent here. Like, none of the three movies we mentioned are unassailably, unequivocally horror movies.
I know. Just interesting is kind of a strange unifying thing, despite all three being rather uncharacteristic of each other. But they do share that common trait of they are not cut and dry, formulaic horror films by any stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting that I'm... You know, only sort of fully realizing now, but it's an interesting fact that managed to, I don't know if that says something about the state of horror right now, like in such a weird year that maybe we are trying to like redefine, you know, the formulas, the tropes of horror in film.
Or the directors. We got a Halloween coming out next year. We're good.
The subject for another episode.
God, if you just, yeah, get me liquored up and then have me go off and rob zombies Halloween.
Oh, I know. We're going to do that. This is going to happen.
I bought the fucking Rob Zombie ones. I bought the fucking Halloween 1, 2, 1 disc DVD. Watched them back to back. open my window, frisbee the fucking DVD on my window.
You did not.
I did. I'm not even joking.
You're getting. I'm taking a sip for that. You're getting a sip.
Yeah, I'm doing a sip. Yeah. So all of these movies, I think, can be found online with a little bit of Googling. Saint Maud, I think, is going to be streaming in a few days. I don't think it is yet, but I think it's in online theaters right now.
Blu-ray DVD right now because I have it.
Okay. And Psycho Goreman, you can see it in online theaters, I think.
Yeah, it's on Shudder right now. Yeah, it's downloadable through all the major platforms. And then the Blu-ray, which is coming in March.
I saw Psycho Goreman by renting it through the Winnipeg Cinematheque. When I can, when I feel generous, I like to support the theaters, the small independent theaters as well.
Same thing I did, yep. Great way to do it.
It's always nice to have a thought for the small theaters we love and make sure that they're still up and running when we get through on the other side of this. Possessor, I think, is currently on Amazon Prime and maybe other services. Well, thanks, Will. Thanks, Sheldon.
Thank you.
We did it.
We did it. And we'll be back very soon with another episode where we're going to drill down real hard on a very specific subgenre of horror movies. And this is going to be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to it. But I'm not going to spoil it just yet.
It'll be fun.
All right. Have a good night, everyone. Keep looking behind you. Joan of Arc with the Lord to guide her. She was a sister who really cooked. Isadora was the first bra burner. Ain't you glad she showed up? Oh, yeah. And when the country was falling apart, Betsy Ross got it all sewed up. And then there's Maud. 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 That uncompromising, enterprising, anything but tranquilizing. Right on, Maud.
I bought the entire collection of Halloween.
I said another episode.
I just want to say, I bought the fucking Rob Zombie one.